Chapter 13. Very careful that he does not anticipate those speakers who come after him. Like Falstaff, with a considerable difference, he has to be the cause of speaking in others. It is rather his duty to sit and hear speeches with exemplary attention than to stand up to make them, so I shall confine myself, in opening these proceedings as your business official, to as plain and as short an exposition as I can possibly give you of the reasons why we come together. First of all, I will take leave to remark that we do not come together in commemoration of Shakespeare. We have nothing to do with any commemoration, except that we are of course humble worshippers of that mighty genius, and that we propose by and by to take his name, but by no means to take it in vain. If, however, the tercentenary celebration were 100 years hence, or 100 years past, we should still be pursuing precisely the same object, though we should not pursue it under precisely the same circumstances. The facts are these. There is, as you know, in existence an admirable institution called the Royal Dramatic College, which is a place of honorable rest and repose for veterans in the dramatic art. The charter of this college, which dates some 5 or 6 years back, expressly provides for the establishment of schools in connection with it, and I may venture to add that this feature of the scheme, when it was explained to him, was specially interesting to His Royal Highness the late Prince Consort, who hailed it as evidence of the desire of the promoters to look forward as well as to look back, to found educational institutions for the rising generation, as well as to establish a harbor of refuge for the generation going out, or at least, having their faces turned towards the setting sun. The leading members of the dramatic art, applying themselves first to the more pressing necessity of the two, set themselves to work on the construction of their harbor of refuge, and this they did with the zeal, energy, goodwill, and good faith that always honorably distinguished them in their efforts to help one another. Those efforts were very powerfully aided by the respected gentleman 14, under whose roof we are assembled, and who, I hope, may be only half as glad of seeing me on these boards as I always am to see him here. With such energy and determination did Mr. Webster and his brothers and sisters in art proceed with their work, that at this present time all the dwelling houses of the Royal Dramatic College are built, completely furnished, fitted with every appliance, and many of them inhabited. The central hall of the college is built, the grounds are beautifully planned and laid out, and the estate has become the nucleus of a prosperous neighborhood. This much achieved, Mr. Webster was revolving in his mind how he should next proceed towards the establishment of the schools, when, this tercentenary celebration being in hand, it occurred to him to represent to the National Shakespeare Committee their just and reasonable claim to participate in the results of any subscription for a monument to Shakespeare. He represented to the committee that the social recognition and elevation of the followers of Shakespeare's own art, through the education of their children, was surely a monument worthy even of that great name. He urged upon the committee that it was certainly a sensible, tangible project, which the public good sense would immediately appreciate and approve. This claim the committee at once acknowledged. But I wish you distinctly to understand that, if the committee had never been in existence, if the tercentenary celebration had never been attempted, those schools, as a design anterior to both, would still have solicited public support. Now, ladies and gentlemen, what it is proposed to do is, in fact, to find a new self-supporting public school, with this additional feature, that it is to be available for both sexes. This, of course, presupposes two separate distinct schools. As these schools are to be built on land belonging to the Dramatic College, there will be from the first no charge, no debt, no encumbrance of any kind under that important head. It is, in short, proposed simply to establish a new self-supporting public school in a rapidly increasing neighborhood, where there is a large and fast accumulating middle class population, and where property in land is fast rising in value. But, inasmuch as the project is a project of the Royal Dramatic College, and inasmuch as the schools are to be built on their estate, it is proposed evermore to give their schools the great name of Shakespeare, and evermore to give the followers of Shakespeare's art a prominent place in them. With this view, it is confidently believed that the public will endow a foundation, say, for 40 foundation scholars, say, 20 girls and 20 boys who shall always receive their education gratuitously, and who shall always be the children of actors, actresses, or dramatic writers. This school, you will understand, is to be equal to the best existing public school. It is to be made to impart a sound, liberal, comprehensive education, and it is to address the whole great middle class at least as freely, as widely, and as cheaply as any existing public school. Broadly, ladies and gentlemen, this is the whole design. There are foundation scholars at Eton, foundation scholars at nearly all our old schools, and if the public, in remembrance of a noble part of our standard national literature, and in remembrance of a great humanizing art, will do this thing for these children, it will at the same time be doing a wise and good thing for itself, and will unquestionably find its account in it. Taking this view of the case, and I cannot be satisfied to take any lower one, I cannot make a sorry face about the poor player. I think it is a term very much misused, and very little understood, being, I venture to say, appropriated in a wrong sense by players themselves. Therefore, ladies and gentlemen, I can only present the player to you exceptionally in this wise, that he follows a peculiar and precarious vocation, a vocation very rarely affording the means of accumulating money, that vocation must, from the nature of things, have in it many undistinguished men and women to one distinguished one, that it is not a vocation the exerciser, of which can profit by the labors of others, but in which he must earn every loaf of his bread in his own person, with the aid of his own face, his own limbs, his own voice, his own memory, and his own life and spirits, and these failing, he fails. Surely this is reason enough to render him some little help in opening for his children their paths through life. I say their paths advisedly, because it is not often found, except under the pressure of necessity, or where there is strong hereditary talent, which is always an exceptional case, that the children of actors and actresses take to the stage. Persons therefore need not in the least fear that, by helping to endow these schools, they would help to overstock the dramatic market. They would do directly the reverse, for they would divert in two channels of public distinction and usefulness those good qualities which would otherwise languish in that market's overrich superabundance. This project has received the support of the head of the most popular of our English public schools. On the committee stands the name of that eminent scholar and gentleman, the Provost of Eton. You justly admire this liberal spirit, and your admiration, which I cordially share, brings me naturally to what I wish to say, that I believe there is not in England any institution so socially liberal as a public school. It has been called a little cosmos of life outside, and I think it is so, with the exception of one of life's worst foibles, for, as far as I know, nowhere in this country is there so complete an absence of servility to mere rank, to mere position, to mere riches as in a public school. A boy there is always what his abilities, or his personal qualities, make him. We may differ about the curriculum and other matters, but of the frank, free, manly, independent spirit preserved in our public schools, I apprehend there can be no kind of question. It has happened in these later times that objection has been made to children of dramatic artists in certain little sniveling private schools, but in public schools never. Therefore, I hold that the actors are wise, and gratefully wise, in recognizing the capacious liberality of a public school, in seeking not a little hole and corner place of education for their children exclusively, but in addressing the whole of the great middle class, and proposing to them to come and join them, the actors, on their own property, in a public school, in a part of the country where no such advantage is now to be found. I have now done. The attempt has been a very timid one. I have endeavored to confine myself within my means, or, rather, like the possessor of an extended estate, to hand it down in an unembarrassed condition. I have laid a trifle of timber here and there, and grubbed up a little brushwood, but merely to open the view, and I think I can descry in the eye of the gentleman who is to move the first resolution, that he distinctly sees his way. Thanking you for the courtesy with which you have heard me, and not at all doubting that we shall lay a strong foundation of these schools today, I will call, as the mover of the first resolution, on Mr. Robert Bell. Speech. London, May 9, 1865. On the above date Mr. Dickens presided at the annual festival of the Newsvendors Benevolent and Provident Association, and, in proposing the toast of the evening, delivered the following speech. Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Johnson's experience of that club, the members of which have traveled over one another's minds in every direction, is not to be compared with the experience of the perpetual president of a society like this. Having on previous occasions said everything about it that he could possibly find to say, he is again produced, with the same awful formalities, to say everything about it that he cannot possibly find to say. It struck me, when Dr. F. Jones was referring just now to Easter Monday, that the case of such an ill-starred president is very like that of the stag at Epping Forest on Easter Monday. That unfortunate animal, when he is uncarted at the spot where the meet takes place, generally makes a point, I am told, of making away at a cool trot, venturesomely followed by the whole field, to the yard where he lives, and there subsides into a quiet and inoffensive existence, until he is again brought out to be again followed by exactly the same field, under exactly the same circumstances, next Easter Monday. The difficulties of the situation, and here I mean the president, and not the stag, are greatly increased in such an instance as this by the peculiar nature of the institution. In its unpretending solidity, reality, and usefulness, believe me, for I have carefully considered the point, it presents no opening whatever of an oratorical nature. If it were one of those costly charities, so called, whose yield of wool bears no sort of proportion to their cry for cash, I very likely might have a word or two to say on the subject. If its funds were lavished in patronage and show, instead of being honestly expended in providing small annuities for hard-working people who have themselves contributed to its funds, if its management were entrusted to people who could by no possibility know anything about it, instead of being invested in plain, business, practical hands, if it hoarded when it ought to spend, if it got by cringing and fawning what it never deserved, I might possibly impress you very much by my indignation. If its managers could tell me that it was insolvent, that it was in a hopeless condition, that its accounts had been kept by Mr. Edmonds or by Tom, if its treasurer had run away with the money box, then I might have made a pathetic appeal to your feelings. But I have no such chance. Just as a nation is happy whose records are barren, so is a society fortunate that has no history and its president unfortunate. I can only assure you that this society continues its plain, unobtrusive, useful career. I can only assure you that it does a great deal of good at a very small cost, and that the objects of its care, and the bulk of its members, are faithful working servants of the public soul, ministers of their wants at untimely hours, in all seasons, and in all weathers, at their own doors, at the street corners, at every railway train, at every steamboat, through the agency of every establishment and the tiniest little shops. And that, whether regarded as master or as man, their profits are very modest, and their risks numerous, while their trouble and responsibility are very great. The newsvendors and newsmen are a very subordinate part of that wonderful engine, the newspaper press. Still, I think we all know very well that they are to the fountainhead what a good service of water pipes is to a good water supply. Just as a goodly store of water at Watford would be a tantalization to thirsty London if it were not brought into town for its use, so any amount of news accumulated at Printing House Square, or Fleet Street, or the Strand, would be if there were no skill and enterprise engaged in its dissemination. We are all of us in the habit of saying in our everyday life that we never know the value of anything until we lose it. Let us try the news vendors by the test. A few years ago we discovered one morning that there was a strike among the cab drivers. Now, let us imagine a strike of newsmen. Imagine the trains waiting in vain for the newspapers. Imagine all sorts and conditions of men dying to know the shipping news, the commercial news, the foreign news, the legal news, the criminal news, the dramatic news. Imagine the paralysis on all the provincial exchanges, the silence and desertion of all the newsmen's exchanges in London. Imagine the circulation of the blood of the nation and of the country standing still, the clock of the world. Why, even Mr. Reuter, the great Reuter whom I am always glad to imagine slumbering at night by the side of Mrs. Reuter, with a galvanic battery under his bolster, bell and wires to the head of his bed, and bells at each ear, think how even he would click and flash those wondrous dispatches of his, and how they would become mere nothing without the activity and honesty which catch up the threads and stitches of the electric needle and scatter them over the land. It is curious to consider, and the thought occurred to me this day, when I was out for a stroll pondering over the duties of this evening, which even then were looming in the distance, but not quite so far off as I could wish. I found it very curious to consider that, though the newsman must be allowed to be a very unpicturesque rendering of Mercury, or fame, or what not conventional messenger from the clouds, and although we must allow that he is of this earth, and has a good deal of it on his boots, still that he has two very remarkable characteristics, to which none of his celestial predecessors can lay the slightest claim. One is that he is always the messenger of civilization, the other that he is at least equally so, not only in what he brings, but in what he ceases to bring. Thus the time was, and not so many years ago either, when the newsman constantly brought home to our doors, though I am afraid not to our hearts, which were custom-hardened, the most terrific accounts of murders, of our fellow creatures being publicly put to death for what we now call trivial offenses, in the very heart of London, regularly every Monday morning. At the same time the newsman regularly brought to us the infliction of other punishments, which were demoralizing to the innocent part of the community, while they did not operate as punishments in deterring offenders from the perpetration of crimes. In those same days, also, the newsman brought to us daily accounts of a regularly accepted and received system of loading the unfortunate insane with chains, littering them down on straw, starving them on bread and water, damaging their clothes, and making periodical exhibitions of them at a small charge, and that on a Sunday one of our public resorts was a kind of demoniacal zoological gardens. They brought us accounts at the same time of some damage done to the machinery which was destined to supply the operative classes with employment. In the same time they brought us accounts of riots for bread, which were constantly occurring and undermining society and the state, of the most terrible explosions of class against class, and of the habitual employment of spies for the discovery, if not for the origination of plots, in which both sides found in those days some relief. In the same time the same newsmen were apprising us of a state of society all around us in which the grossest sensuality and intemperance were the rule, and not as now, when the ignorant, the wicked, and the wretched are the inexcusably vicious exceptions, a state of society in which the professional bully was rampant, and when deadly duels were daily fought for the most absurd and disgraceful causes. All this the newsman has ceased to tell us of. This state of society has discontinued in England forever, and when we remember the undoubted truth that the change could never have been effected without the aid of the load which the newsman carries. Surely it is not very romantic to express the hope on his behalf that the public will show to him some little token of the sympathetic remembrance which we are all of us glad to bestow on the bearers of happy tidings, the harbingers of good news. Now, ladies and gentlemen, you will be glad to hear that I am Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.